Okay, well, let's see what's happening anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they
changed
the vaccine spot.
Oh, fine,
but I'm sorry, like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
All right, Lisa,
are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
UFO over New York, and I ain't too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Yeah, that would be me, and this would be program 383 in the current series of Strange Days Indeed, the program that reflects the UFO side of the strangeness. Welcome, Victor Vigiani.
Good evening, Errol.
Yeah, it's not like you haven't been here lately.
Routine.
Yes, it's
routine.
It's becoming comfortable, and I notice that your chair is very fond of you. It's just enveloping you.
I kind of feel that way. It sort of fits.
Yeah, it's the Saturday night seat, isn't
it? Yeah, it's kind of comfy.
It is. It has a certain comfort level about it, as does Dave Frelott, a regular weekly contributor to this program. He'll be along here very shortly, as will our British correspondent and the publisher-editor of UFO Review, Stuart Miller, live on the phone from 3 o'clock in the morning in his time zone in Cheshire in Northern England. And in the second hour, Canadian documentary producer David Cherniak will join us here in studio to discuss his current project that relates to UFOs.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah, amazing man, David Cherniak.
Very
was
focused.
The producer of Man Alive for CBC TV for years. Yeah. He's now an independent producer. The names that he is involved with directly is jaw-dropping.
It's just a telephone book of who's who.
It is. It is. And David Cherniak will be with us in the second hour.
Looking forward to it.
Lots of stuff going on out there this past week.
That Cassini situation with the water.
Let's bring in our space correspondent and get into some of that, because that's not the only thing going on out there. Good evening, Michael J. Woods.
Good evening, Errol Bruce Knapp. And good evening, Vin.
You just fell off the table, right? A little bit early for you today, or is it too late?
Well, actually, you know, you're way past my bedtime. I work on Greenwich Mean Time.
The breakfast television guy.
Exactly.
I know. Yeah. Michael J. Woods, as I said, a good lot going on out there in space this past week.
Well, as Victor just mentioned, first Cassini. I mean, we have now three planets, or three spheres beyond Earth that contain water. We know Mars has got water. It's shown it to us and everything except a geyser.
Or a geezer.
Well, you're here, so that's covered.
yeah, thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you for that setup.
Hey, listen, it's a pleasure.
One of Jupiter's moons, Io, I believe it is shown, Europa has shown indications that it could be water there.
Mm-hmm.
And now Enceladus.
Enceladus, yeah.
And so this has shown, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it's spewing icy particles in a plume 300 kilometers tall off the surface of the planet. That's as far as I'm going to take it. There was a lot of people that were getting all wet in themselves about the possibility of life. No, what this is the probability of water.
Where there's water, that you can be pretty darn sure that there's a possibility of life.
Okay, there's a possibility of life, but, you know, just because the politician is breathing doesn't mean there's the possibility of intelligence, but it doesn't mean you're going to get any, you know what I mean?
Before we get into all of that, could you just give us an idea of the size of these moons? Did you have any idea Like, how big are these things? Are they regular moon size? That
bigger than a bread box?
Yeah. Well, is it Earth size, or what are we talking about?
No, no, we're not talking Earth size here. We're much smaller than Earth, but you know they're larger than our own moon.
Okay.
Hmm.
Okay.
So, other than NASA giving Walter Cronkite a piece of moon rock, what other space news is
there?
Well,
the big one, of course, is that the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has arrived.
Oh, yes.
And that's, you know, that's the big one as far as anyone is concerned right now. Just pulled into a position for a six-month slowdown phrase, but it arrived at Mars after about 7 months travel Friday about lunchtime.
Mm.
Now, we've discussed the Mars curse many times before on this show.
And they seem to maybe have got it right this time.
This time they seem to have done it, but two-thirds of all probes sent to Mars fail. That's the flat numbers. Now, this was $450 million worth of hardware. Massive. This is a big puppy with a solar array on it. It's the largest ever sent out into interplanetary space.
It's the size of a London double-decker bus.
Well, the solar array is 18 by 6 wide, 18 feet by 6 feet wide. This thing has the absolute latest state-of-the-art equipment on board. The promise is this will gather 10 times more information than all the other missions combined.
So will they re-photograph yet again the Cydonia region?
Well, we're all going to hold our breath until our faces turn blue and demand it, but whether or not it actually happens.
And those amazing high-res images that are supposed to be coming out of that new orbiter will be very telling.
This is supposed to be able to tell us down to tabletop size.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the size of definition on this.
Ooh.
Yeah, really, really good. Now, The thing of it here is that when you consider the last two missions that went to Mars from NASA, one just its engines didn't burn, and so it's God knows where it went. And the second one, well, geez, they did that, got confused between metric and imperial measurements, and it sort of started slowing down 3 foot after it made impact with the surface of Mars, which is really not good for, you know, further study.
Fire the retrojet.
Yeah, whoops. Oh, well, that heck with them. We're stopped. This time, this thing was coming in at Mars after 7 months journey. It approached doing 11,000 miles an hour, and that's a really high number. So let's put it into a kind of a number we can all wrap our heads around. That's 5 kilometers a second. So that's real quick.
Yeah, so it has to spend the next, 6 months, orbiting and slowly decreasing its
speed. Yeah, exactly, aerobraking. It's going to slowly dip into what little atmosphere Mars has until 6 months from now it's flying about 300 kilometers above the surface, whereas currently it's got an orbit that's right out there. It's like 28,000 miles to about 264 miles.
Wow. That's that's going to be worth the wait if it starts sending back spectacular images, and I really want to see what those worms are that wend their way in
exactly.
and out of the ravines.
There's all sorts of features.
Yeah.
The trees at the South Pole and all that.
Exactly.
Figure late summer, early fall, we'll start getting pictures.
Well, we'll talk to you before then, though.
I sure hope so.
So do I. Michael J. Woods.
Here with his take on it is Dave Furlott.
There's a thread on the UFO updates list that begins Santilli and the cameraman. And of course, it is all about how Ray Santilli could have gotten the film from the cameraman of the now infamous alien autopsy film. One of the questions that comes out is whether Ray Santilli was an innocent man duped into buying a film of questionable authenticity, or did he and the cameraman actually put together this alleged film of the autopsy of alien creatures. Now, the bottom line in all of this is the film itself and how it came about to be in the hands of the cameraman to be able to trade or sell or, I don't know, collect the silver nitrates from the film and turn it all in for a few bucks. But, and drumroll here, please, I have the honor of being able to identify the unknown cameraman of the alien autopsy film. You see, Our cameraman identified himself as being the official cameraman for the test shot at the Trinity site, the place where the USA exploded the world's first atomic bomb. And through a little hunting, I have discovered the names of two men who were, you guessed it, the official photographer and cinematographer for the Trinity site. The man in charge of shooting film for the Trinity site is none other than Berlin B. Brixner, born in 1911. The official photographer, Jack Abbey, shot one of the few color stills of the Trinity explosion, but since he was a still photographer, our cameraman would have to be none other than Berlin Brixner. But there's one teeny tiny problem with this. Mr. Brixner was a civilian and not in the military. Not only this, but he was an engineer who developed high-speed cinematography to catch each sequence of an explosion. So, alas, the mystery deepens. Now, the whole Santilli and cameraman thread got caught up in how he got to keep only the worst footage of the autopsy and how he took the reels back to the base to develop them and how he took them home, etc., etc. Now, this led to me doing a little more digging. And here's the way it works if you're a photographer or a cinematographer in the military, at least according to the members of the International Combat Camera Association. Full accountability for all film, regardless of the amount, would be enforced. You check out 20 rolls, you turn in 20 rolls. In other words, the military would kind of frown on somebody trying to keep a roll or two of film, and I suspect they would be asking for some pretty substantial reason for being 22 or so rolls short when you did turn it all back in. Now, the other comment by the ICCA about how things would be handled was interesting as well. It read, "We concluded that under any circumstances, a single motion picture cameraman would not be sent alone on such an important assignment. A team of at least two motion picture operators and a stills man would be considered a team. 16 millimeter film would not have been used. 35 millimeter color would have been the required film stock." Now, I by no means consider myself to be especially knowledgeable about how the U.S. military handles the photography and cinematography of important events, but here's what it boils down to if we take the comments of the alleged cameraman at face value. He was ordered to drop everything he was doing and get on an aircraft to go shoot some footage of a crash site by General McMullen, who is the deputy commander of Strategic Air Command. And apparently another general, General Carl Spatz, got involved and reiterated the order, telling him that it was simply a downed Russian spy plane. Now he, along with others, mostly medical officers, got to the site where they were waiting for General George C. Kenney. And he was the commander of Strategic Air Command. And they were waiting for him to show up. Okay, now let's get this straight. You have three of the most important generals in the U.S. military involved, but the cameraman, the only one, does not arrive with anything but a 16-millimeter camera with some very cheap, if you take a look at the footage, black and white film, and no tripod. Not only that, but when he's done shooting, he simply gathers up all the cads and takes them away to do whatever he wants. Nobody bothers to say, how come you're short 22 rolls here? The whole testimony of the cameraman for the supposed alien autopsy film sounds perfectly plausible and real, provided you place your ability to process reality on the shelf. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong every week at this time.
Well,
strange days, indeed.
Well, strange days. I'll just talk all over Maria. It's an interesting, actually, Dave, that you would point that out, and nicely done. It doesn't make sense. They didn't, you know, you don't go and shoot that kind of thing without sticks. Something to stand a camera on so that it stays nice and steady.
Not unless it's your very first day operating as a photographer or a cinematographer.
And I forgot to take the lens cap off. Oops.
Unless you really want to make it look spontaneous and move it all around, you know. I mean, here, jerk here and swish there and bump here.
Yeah, but shaky cam wasn't invented until Much Music or MTV just a little while ago.
Or the Blair Witch Project.
They had no bodies to deal with either.
We need to leave it at that, Dave.
I think so.
I think that's enough said for the time being. We'll talk to you next week.
For sure.
Thank you, Dave. Yet another good one. UFO Review is a free monthly zine published on the web, and always look forward to the latest issue. Number 15 has just hit Stuart Miller's website. Each issue carries extensive interviews with those in the ufological field and associated subjects, as well as contributed articles, contributed regular features, comments, cartoons, and usually a wee dose of satire thrown in somewhere as well. So that's pretty good. Yes, they operate in an accessible format and welcome unsolicited articles, provided the people writing them are sane and reasonably articulate. And you can reach the editor, publisher of UFO Review, Stuart Miller, here once a month, second Saturday of the month, and joining us on the line, where it's 3 a.m. in the morning in Cheshire, is Stuart Miller. Morning, Stuart.
And a very good evening to you, Errol, and to you, Victor.
Good evening.
And how are you, Monsieur Miller?
I'm counting, Errol. I've had a Scottish accent and now a French accent. It makes a change from the usual Cockney accent you deliver to me.
Well, yes, but then I could do many others too, but they're politically incorrect nowadays, unfortunately.
I'm fine, Errol.
Good.
I'm fine.
Good to hear. And 15th issue under your belt, and good one again, huh?
Thank you very much, yes. Mm-hmm. And I believe you had Nick Redfern on last week.
Last week, yes. Yes.
It's featured quite heavily in
this issue. Yeah. And Mr. Redfern getting about a bit again, isn't he?
Yeah. Yes. And upsetting people, I think, here and there.
Yeah, yeah. You can't send an email anywhere without upsetting someone. That's the problem.
I'm fascinated, actually, by the fuss you lot are making about this NASA Mars orbiter thing. That's just got up there.
Who's making a fuss? We're merely reporting on it.
But the European Space Agency has had something up there, the Mars Express, for yonks.
Well, yeah, but they lost a Beagle too, and
We may have lost a Beagle too, Errol. Something that you choose to remind me about every time we speak.
I do not.
You do, sir.
I'm going to have to go back and listen to the recordings and make note of the number of times I didn't.
This is something that we're way ahead of in Europe with over NASA.
You're way ahead with culture. I mean, let's face it, and technology and broadcast technology. You're way ahead with everything.
We're not. Broadcast technology?
Yes.
No.
Yes. Believe me, I work both sides of the pond.
Well, you've got high-definition TV now, haven't you?
Yes.
We haven't.
You don't?
We don't yet. Nobody's actually broadcasting an HD TV, although it might kick off at some time later this year.
I don't know why. I thought the Beeb was out. I know the Beeb is out there in digital audio broadcasting.
We're certainly, when it comes to broadband, we're getting to be, certainly I think we're the leading country for take-up in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not too bad in the rest of the world either. Hmm. But no, I don't think North America is at least on the same level as us.
Ah, well, but we digress.
We do.
We do indeed.
We do.
Is there what has been tickling your ufological fancy these past few weeks?
Well, I've got something here that, firstly, I have to apologize for not sending it in to you.
Mm-hmm.
It was an oversight.
Mm-hmm. So what did you miss sending me?
I missed sending you a newspaper article headlined, "Have you ever noticed that no good-looking people believe in alien abductions?" Well, oh, I'll tell you something, Errol. If you are laughing, if you are laughing at that headline, you wait till you read, till I tell you what the guy says in this interview. I'll tell you who the guy is. You might have heard his name. I hadn't, actually, but apparently he's got a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list at the moment. Dr. Laban Shrewsbury. And the book that's up there, although this is not the basis of the, this newspaper article, is "Use Your Head and Stop Being Such a Loser, You Loser." Dr. Shrewsbury, Shrewsbury, is the head of the SETI project at Mount Cadath in Arkham, Massachusetts. And he spoke, in Michigan, at the Wicked Scholar Society as part of their "Let's Debunk Everything and Make People Look Stupid" lecture series. Believe it or not. Right. Okay, he goes on about his career searching for extraterrestrial life. He's been at it for 35 years. And then he gets on to alien abductions. First of all, most of the people who report that they have been abducted are not at all attractive, and many are downright ugly. Second, almost to a person, they are uneducated and quite stupid. Intelligent, critical thinkers, of course, instantly recognize abduction stories for what they really are, the adolescent fantasies of pathetic, fat, stupid people with empty, meaningless lives.
Oh, my.
I know, and believe it or not...
I can't believe that, Stuart.
I'll tell you what, Victor, it gets worse. It really does. You either laugh or cry with this, and I've been laughing. But, I mean, hang on a sec. The rich, successful, well-educated, and good-looking do not believe in alien abductions unless they are mentally ill. Several years ago, I conducted a survey of people who believe they'd been the victims of an alien abduction to create a profile of the typical abductee. Oddly enough, there is a very strong correlation between the type of vehicle a person drives and whether or not they believe in an alien abduction. 73% of people who have reported an abduction incident drive a pickup truck that is more than 10 years old. Wait for the next bit. 98% of the pickups have two or more body panels that are different colors.
This is absolutely... Keep going, Stuart. I mean, this is going to blow us off the radio, my friend. Keep going.
The favorite recreational activity or sport of 92% of the people who reported they've been abducted was watching professional wrestling, hunting, and stock car racing. 75% of abductees live in a mobile home in the southern United States. Interestingly, there is not a single alien abduction report from Europe, Africa, or Asia. Oh, my.
Oh, Lord.
You have to laugh at that. You're right. You have to laugh at it. My goodness.
Velez would explode.
Most people who believe in alien abductions are stupid and poorly educated. Explaining the realities of physics, biology, chemistry, and astronomy is like trying to describe a jet engine to a chimpanzee. It's a futile activity.
Oh, God.
It's really funny because Errol and I were talking earlier yesterday, and he was asking me, he put me on to looking at the DVD Touched, and I viewed it a couple of times. Actually, I viewed it twice, Errol. And it just, from what you're saying, if anyone has seen that that documentary, it's absolutely amazing what you're saying in contrast to the people that are on that who are extremely articulate and, by the way, very good looking.
Yeah.
I mean, and neither one of them drive a pickup truck with different panel parts that are... that is just absolutely and stupendously stupid. I cannot believe that anyone would write that kind of tripe.
I'll send the article in to you, Harry. Oh, I do apologize for omitting it.
And I think we have to apologize to all the people who are listening out there on a serious note who have been through this. And I do have to say that because, you know, it is something very serious, but I know that even these people have a sense of humor, too.
Well, yes, and a point well made, Victor. I have to say, I have fundamentally disagreed with Stan Friedman's attitude towards SETI over the years, but I have to say, it's certainly in connection with this, the guy has a point. I mean, this is just disgusting. Even allowing for the atmosphere in which he made the speech, which, let's face it, judging by the "let's debunk everything and make people look stupid" lecture series, is obviously some college's idea of something amusing, and he's obviously entered into the spirit of it.
Yeah, yeah. You do need to send that to me, and I do need to post it. And do we have an email address for this guy?
No, not surprisingly.
I bet we could track him down pretty darn quickly.
Well, he's got a bestseller on the New York Times.
Well, yeah. Did you see that post to the list today, Stuart Miller, PsyCop encouraging people to hoax UFO pictures for prize money?
I did, yes. It's a couple of societies, the Center for Inquiry and the Tallahassee Skeptics.
Yeah, same difference.
Yeah. Well, I've never heard of either of them, actually.
Yeah, a bunch of maroons.
Yeah, it's depressing, isn't it? Because Microsoft ran a similar competition in the UK a few months ago.
Which
our man from the ministry, Mr. Nick Pope, was heavily involved in as a contest judge.
Was he?
He was.
Well, that's odd.
Well, exactly. You'd have thought he wouldn't have touched it with a barge.
Yeah, well, I mean, why just, you know, cloud the issue with more cloud?
Well, because it's publicity, possibly a small fee, and the chance to see your name on the internet.
Ah.
Oh, sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
Oh,
dear.
Did you say that? I think Nick stays up and listens late, although he might sort of go grab the download version.
Oh, no, he's too busy with his media appearances.
Yes. Oh, but how do you really feel about him?
Well, no, Nick's okay, He's the subject of a lot of criticism in the UK amongst ufologists, as you may well have gathered by the list. I personally don't have a problem with him or what he claims. I mean, for example, you know, people pick on him because he uses the term the UFO project that he worked on when he was on the MOD UFO desk.
The Ministry of Defence in Britain, yes.
Well, a lot of people quibble with his description of, or his use of the word project, because it implies a grander scheme than that really actually existed. So they pick on him for little things like that. Basically, he seems to irritate a lot of people, if the truth be told. I think he's got two things going on. Yes, he's trying to promote his own career, and there's no harm in that. People do that.
Mm-hmm.
And he is trying to promote ufology as well. He does do that, and he does it fairly successfully.
Yes.
And the point is, it's in many ways, it's typically English, and I say English as opposed to British, English whinging and moaning, because people moan about him and about the fact that he's in the media all the time, but nobody else steps forward to try, you know, and sort of take his place, so to speak.
Well,
all they do is moan, but nobody actually does anything about it.
Yeah, well, that happens all over the place. I mean, it's not just in this field, but in all fields, you know. Yeah, they all grumble and whinge and do nothing.
Indeed.
Yeah.
In the meantime, there's no doubt about it. As far as the media are concerned, he is the face of British ufology.
Yes. We have about a minute left, Stuart.
Right. Well, I just wanted to add something about the discovery by Cassini of plumes of water on
Enceladus.
Enceladus, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have the misfortune to live with an out-and-out skeptic, and I was getting all excited about this, and she just turns around and says, "Yeah, so what?" And it's really deflating. I mean, no grasp of the significance of what this means, because, like with a lot of women, I think, my wife is concerned with the day-to-day practicalities of life here on this planet, and isn't desperately interested in what's going on a few thousand or a few million miles away from us.
Yes, or even in the skies above us, or
indeed,
in the ground outside.
Or even outside the front door, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Stuart Miller, thank you. Our time together has once again been frittered away by idle chit-chat.
It's been absorbing, intellectually stimulating, and very entertaining.
Stuart Miller will be back with us the second Saturday of next week. Good night, Stuart Miller. Our guest this hour is a Toronto filmmaker, and former producer of Man Alive on CBC Television. Some amazing, amazing programs that David Cherniak put together in his time there, and has put some interesting, interesting in the most flattering way possible, a man who has traveled the world with his video camera and continues to do so today. In fact, he's in the middle of a project that is UFO related, and that's why David is in studio with us tonight.
Yes,
good evening, David. Welcome.
Hi there, Errol. It's nice to be here on this side of the mic. I have been in here before.
Yes, you were actually shooting here when the Disclosure conference was happening here in Toronto at Convocation Hall.
It was a good way to pick up some inexpensive interviews, you know.
Yeah.
Courtesy of Victor, all these wonderful people.
Stanton Friedman and Stephen Bassett and...
what's his name? The guy who wrote the book.
The guy who wrote the book that everybody isn't very happy with. Or some people aren't very happy.
Yet it's a good book because there are so few good books on the subject that treat it historically.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from Dave Jacobs' book, which was his PhD thesis and published in 1973, there's really very few... There's no composite histories.
Yeah, like Richard Dolan's.
Like Richard Dolan's.
Yeah.
Yeah. As flawed as it may be.
Yeah. He seemed to upset a couple of the old-timers quite nicely, though.
I could feel the vibes.
Yeah. No, it's always good to upset old-timers.
Yeah.
My thesis, anyway.
Don't look in my direction. No, when we say old-timers in this field, we mean the 70s and 80-year-olds who are still around. It's quite amazing.
Do people live that long these days?
Yeah, they do. Well, look at the Friedmans and the Halls. You know?
Oh, I thought so.
And the Jerry Clarks.
I hope he's not listening.
There are some old-timers that haven't reached 50 yet. So, they're thinking as old-time. Let's put it that way.
Exactly.
Jerry Clark went directly from being the boy wonder to the old guy.
That's what happens when you write an encyclopedia, right?
Yes, yeah.
So the film, yes.
The film.
Is for the Canadian History Channel, and it's a 2-hour documentary, and it's a history of the UFO phenomena. And we're taking it to be a social, political, mythological history of the UFO phenomena. So the title of the film right now, the working title, is UFOs and the Politics of Reality.
And that leaves you open to all kinds of directions.
To do a lot of things. But, what interests me, what always interests me, is what people consider real and why they consider it real and how they've come to consider it real.
Mm.
You know, and regardless of what factual basis underlies the UFO phenomena, there could very well be real extraterrestrials flitting around and treating us like an anthropological study. Regardless of what that reality actually is, there's a very strong mythological overlay which we as a culture have put onto the phenomena. We have treated it almost like a Rorschach inkblot. It's become representative of our hopes and our fears as they've shifted from, the late 40s right into the 2000 and whatever you would call this decade, right? And I think it shifted profoundly, We can talk about it as we go along, but it's very well known that at the beginning, anyways, how people were reacting to the phenomena, it was at least once they started to consider the extraterrestrial hypothesis, probably in about 48, 49, the True Magazine article by Kehoe at the end of 49 in the January issue of 50 of True, really raised for the first time the extraterrestrial hypothesis and brought it public with the whole idea the Air Force was covering it up. And I think people were already thinking that, but like anything else, like anything that lands like a bombshell and explodes in the popular consciousness, it was predecessed by a lot of popular thinking going on at that time. And in those early days, I think very much the phenomena was a response to the Cold War, very much it was a response, how people reacted to the phenomena, what they put onto the phenomena, if you want. It was very much a response to the bomb. You take a look at the early contactees and their popularity. They were playing on the fact that people were terrified of mass destruction. And I think as we will elaborate these themes, you know, how the phenomena has reflected the hopes and fears through the decades, you know, we'll get into the 80s and feelings of mass disempowerment and globalization and how they affected the phenomena with, if you want, you know, the X-Files, the whole dark side hypothesis. You know, it's very interesting.
You used the term a second ago, the politics of reality, and being a sociology major myself, I've not heard that from you because of the nature of the film you're making. Why did you choose that term, the politics of reality? Because in sociology, it has a very deep meaning in terms of.
Go ahead, tell me what it means in sociology.
Well, I'm not quite sure. It's the way people negotiate what they believe is real. It's a negotiated thing. I think something has a whole lot of significance to it, and another person doesn't.
I would take issue with the word negotiate in the sense that it implies a very conscious deliberation. And I think most of how this mythological overlay on the phenomena has worked has been very unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets us into another area that's really interesting me these days as I'm scripting, and it's the whole role that intelligence agencies have played in the development of how the phenomena is perceived to mm-hmm. be real. You know, as we read through the early history, which is now pretty clear what went on from about 47 through to the end of the Robertson panel, and subsequently, you know, what was established by the Robertson panel, the intelligence agencies got very involved. And I've been reflecting on this whole idea of what intelligence is. You know, it's not just the gathering of information. That's I think a very narrow way to look at it. And I think if anybody who's listening out there is an intelligence agent, and there probably are a few, right? I think they might agree that it's not just the gathering of information. It's also the manipulation of information, the manipulation of what's perceived as real. This is another theme that we're definitely going to be exploring in those 2 hours in the film.
Mm.
So that's what I mean by the politics of reality, a very political thing. If you stop to think, you know, the decisions that were made very early on, let's assume that the people in the newly formed CIA and in Air Force intelligence came to the conclusion, well, you know, we're being observed by an extraterrestrial, if not more than one extraterrestrial presence. What are we going to tell our population?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know who it is, what they're doing here, why they're here, what their intentions are. We're going to tell them that, you know? The whole idea of UFOs is a very subversive idea. And because it's a subversive idea, I think the intelligence agencies got very actively involved very, very early on, and have remained actively involved.
Our guest tonight is David Cherniak, a filmmaker. UFOs and the Politics of Reality is the current two-hour documentary that he is working on. And we were at the college, the girls' college in Michigan. And what was the name of the college again?
It's Hillsdale College.
Hillsdale. Thank you.
And
Pinky and Gidget.
And Gidget had gone down to Pinky's room. Now, for those of you who just tuned in, if there are anybody who's just tuned in, I should point out that this whole story was predicated on the tale that was told to Bill Vincent of fraternity pledges going out and in the swamp beside the arboretum and covering themselves up with a plastic sheet with flares and running around pretending they were a UFO, and these girls are now starting to see something in the arboretum that looks like that. It could be like that. Anyways, I'll just pick it up here.
From the school newspaper.
Yes, from the school newspaper. I think already Mr. Van Horn, the civil defense director, has arrived, and they've been watching this thing for about a half hour. No, she's speaking to Mr. Van Horn. This is one of the other girls, and they're watching this thing out in the arb. At a distance, I saw it. I was sitting in that dorm taking a look. It's about 500, 600 yards away that they were looking at this, whatever it was, if not more. Anyway, so they see police cars going up and down the road. And at this time, we discovered the object was on the south side of the road and appeared to be sitting in the baseball field. The police car came back up the road, and we noticed that the lights were nearly on level with the object. The car drove right by as if they hadn't seen the object. But the object had seen the car because it started to act frantic. It went up and down and back and forth fast and jerkily as if it didn't know what to do. You can just imagine these poor fraternity pledges thinking they're going to be spending the night in the clink. So I think, and then it goes on, and then Mr. Van Horn arrives and they look at this thing and they think they see it moving, and he becomes convinced it is a bona fide UFO. Although Dr. Hynek mentioned he didn't spend much time at Hillsdale College. I think somebody had told him that they had discovered flares out in the swamp. And I think rather than make a big deal of it and embarrass a lot of people, he didn't really want to go into it. So he didn't spend much time. I'm just guessing. That's mm-hmm. speculation.
So to go back to the beginning of the story.
The beginning of the story seems to be a bona fide UFO experience.
Yeah, because she saw it in the air.
And describes an object that looked very much like the drawings that were done by the people who saw the object at the Manor Farm at Dexter a few nights previously. Mm-hmm. Almost exactly the same. They both described a squash football-shaped object with lights configured in the same way. Hmm. So it was fascinating. But what's fascinating about Gidget Cohn's description is she spends all night at her window looking for this. After the lights in the swamp disappear, she sees another light in the sky, and it becomes for her like some emotional attachment. You know, she describes it as my friend, you know, and it obviously became very meaningful to her. And she's, after it finally disappears, or whatever she was watching, whatever light in the sky she was watching, at about 5:10 in the morning, all the other girls have gone to bed, she's still sitting at her window for another half hour waiting for it to come back.
Aww.
Isn't that sweet?
That really is.
Yeah, I'd like to find Gidget Cohn.
My next question.
We're trying. But you know, they marry and their names change. And even though the school, being a Tony school, keeps track of its alumni, we haven't had too much success yet. So
that's too bad.
Gidget, if you're listening, get in touch.
And you can get in touch with David Cherniak via tonight's program listing. If you click either his name or the film producer link, and it should be filmmaker.
Yes.
That will take you to David's website.
Oh,
yes, right. And they can read all about you there and all the amazing documentaries that you have made in the past.
I've made quite a few.
And all of them amazing.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I've had a very fortunate career as far as documentary filmmakers go. I've always been able to do films that I've been very passionate about and found very interesting to do.
You did one of the first television coverage programs on the abduction phenomenon.
I probably did the very first film on the abduction phenomenon. I came across it at, I wanted to do a film for Men Alive on UFOs, and I went down to the Lansing MUFON conference in, I think it was 85 or 86, and met Bud and Dave. And they sent me stuff. I think I got the galleys for Bud's book, Intruders. And actually the galleys for Communion. And we did a film with Bud. We brought him up here, and he did hypnosis with two local abductees who had contacted him, and we made a film about him for Man Alive. It was, I think, the very first film on abduction. So quite an interesting film because of what happened in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I still have a videotape of that when it went to air.
Yeah, when the two abductees came together, who we had been concentrating on, they had described, both of them had described meeting each other within an abduction experience, and yet they had never met one another in the flesh.
Yeah.
So what happened was we went out to Roy Bonesteel, the host of the program's farmhouse, for a week. and did hypnosis with one of the abductees, and then had a party where we invited a bunch of abductees and told the two ladies who had supposedly seen one another in their abduction experiences that the others would not, that the other would not be there.
Mm.
And then we injected the second one into the party a little bit late and without saying a word to anybody. Bud knew. And she joined a conversation with Bud Hopkins and the other abductees and started to ask Bud a question. And the other lady turned around immediately, looked her up and down, and said, Betty?
Wow.
Dorothy? Yeah. But, you know, she had a very distinctive voice, and they had talked on the phone. And at that moment, I realized, you know, it could have been a little bit of recognition of the voice.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing that happened immediately afterwards, we were having a buffet dinner and filming, and everybody was standing around the table, and Dorothy says to Betty, you know, I thought I recognized you, but your hair was different in the experience. And Betty, who had a very wry sense of humor, kind of reaches up and says, it is different, and lifts up her wig.
Interesting.
That was the nicest moment in the film.
She's moved to Ottawa now, but there was a woman in the city called Kathy Johnson, and I don't know if you've come across that name before. Kathy was not an abductee. She went willingly as a child out in British Columbia and had some really quite remarkable experiences. And then she moved to Ontario when she grew up and was a truck driver and did runs down into the States and made it a point while she was into the down in the States of tracking down people that she had been aboard a UFO with and had managed to track down at least a half a dozen of those people. How, I don't know, but she did.
It's fascinating. I did come across a lady who claimed to have been abducted with Whitley Strieber. He said he recognized her.
It's a constant theme in the experience.
It is. It's a very fascinating experience, abductions. I'm not sure whether it's one experience. I think it's probably many, many different kinds of experiences going on.
Whoa. There's just so many directions to go in, isn't there?
Sure.
And just every single one of them is fascinating and an endless road over the horizon. You've always shot your own style of documentary, and presumably you're getting funding from various sources here in Canada.
No, actually, the entire amount of money is coming from the History Channel, and the History Channel's access to the television fund and to telefilm.
Yeah.
So all the money's coming through.
How do you doing a documentary for the Canadian History Channel, and through them getting funding from those funds, how do you manage to travel south of the border in order to be able to do a Canadian documentary?
I see where you're going with this.
Yeah.
Well, in Canadian documentary filmmaking, there's essentially a couple of different strands that are recognized by the funding agencies, and one of them is called POV Auteur. And due to my background and the places where I went to get educated in my filmmaking, Central Europe, actually the Prague Film Academy, I learned how to do films that way, and I've always done films that way. So this film is being done as a personal point of view documentary.
This is good, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So your voice will narrate it.
Yes, my voice will narrate it. It'll be my personal, my personal point of view through the history of the phenomenon, which, as you can see, I have a few opinions.
Yeah, well, and you've steeped yourself well in it all.
Well, I've been interested in the phenomena since I was 13. I was a boy astronomer. I got interested in astronomy at age between 6 and 7. Kind of had a small UFO sighting when I was about 13 years of age. Interesting because it really wasn't very, strong, powerful or anything, but it did have an impact on me. Mm. I was home from school. I was 13 years old, home from school at lunch, and heard a news report on the radio saying UFO seen over Winnipeg, kids hiding under their beds. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. It got me all excited. So when I was walking back to school in this very clear blue prairie sky, At about 12 o'clock high, I saw stationary, very high up, a red dot that just sat there for 10 to 15 minutes without moving. I measured it against the side of the school wall. It didn't move one iota. I asked my schoolmates, do you see that? Figuring, you know, maybe I'm seeing spots before my eyes. I said, oh, yeah, we see that. Yeah. So? So what? And it was gone when I came out from school, but I went to the library and got every single book I could on UFOs that night. So I got interested at a very early age. I came to certain conclusions very quickly. I came to the conclusion that if we were being visited, you know, we weren't going to really get the truth out of it. If they managed to cover it up so far, that they're going to continue to cover it up. And I kind of lost interest, got interested in girls, went off to school. There was actually a UFO plap in Prague when I was there. And so we went out nights and looked for things, but didn't see too much. And when the first man alive was offered me, you know, do you want to do something on UFOs? I actually had to think about it and think, is there anything really new to say here that hasn't been said? And when I discovered abductions, the answer was affirmative. And then I did another one. I did an hour a little bit later, which on abductions, that was called Sky Magic. It wasn't so much on abductions. It was beginning to approach this mythological overlay to the phenomena. And in that film were people like Ken Ring and Peter Roy Sevich and David Gottlieb. And a lot of the filming was done at the abduction conference at MIT.
There you go. Yeah. I wish I had been there.
It was a sentinel event.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Much more so than Roswell 97.
I think much more so than a few of... I haven't been to many UFO conferences. Yeah. They actually... I don't find them too exciting. They're fascinating anthropology. Not really that much new to learn there. If you're a ufologist and really heavily interested in doing research, that makes sense. But for me as an observer, you know, it's just seeing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I got that feeling, and I haven't been to that many UFO conferences, but I don't know what it is, but as I've said before, you know, I fall asleep.
Yeah.
I would much sooner stand around outside and talk than be inside.
I saw you at Victor's conference. You were asleep.
Oh, you're bad. We have about 4 minutes left.
God, time flies when
it
you're
does. Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
I could stay for another hour. Just tell them to keep rolling.
As soon as you step in the studio, somebody fools around with that clock of time.
The next hour, you have to talk about tantric sex.
Oh, okay. I don't know too much about that, but... You wanted to talk a little bit in those 4 minutes about the Tibetan stuff.
Yeah, because the Tibetans have been around for so long and have such deep culture.
I should point out that one of my other interests is Tibetan Buddhism.
Yes.
And the present film that I'm working on is on Tibetan oracles that the Dalai Lama gave me very unique permission to do.
It's not many filmmakers can say that they have access to the Dalai Lama.
Well, I've known him
basis.
For about 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's for me a very special relationship. Mm-hmm.
The reason that I asked you about it on the phone last night, whenever, I think it was last night, was that in the Shakya tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, it's the only lineage that is handed down from father to son. It's not a reincarnate lineage.
Right.
And the story of the Treason family is that they came down off one of the tallest mountains in Tibet in the dead of winter.
Right.
The locals knew that absolutely nobody could live on that mountain. But the family, the mother, the father, the son, and the daughter, came down off the mountain lightly clad, smiling away, and proceeded to create miracles all around them.
Yeah.
And that's how the Shakya lineage started. The name means sky people.
Yeah.
So that was what prompted my suggesting that we might touch on...
Well, one of the interesting myths that the Tibetans have is called Shambhala. Mm-hmm. And it formed the basis for Shangri-La, for that story. And in the Shambhala myth, there is an enlightened civilization living in a hidden valley, but could be elsewhere. The hidden valley is somewhere to the north. And that enlightened civilization, at some point in the future, and there's some speculation on dates and things, is going to appear. And there will be kind of a, this is like a very apocalyptic kind of thing. There will be a battle between the forces of good and, or the forces of enlightenment and the forces of ignorance. And in fact, the whole Kala Chakra initiation that the Dalai Lama runs around and has been giving for years and years. Part of that is one takes a vow to come back and help out during those times, to actually reincarnate if one can. During those times. And the Tibetans, you know, ever since they kind of came in contact with the modern world and came in contact with the whole UFO mythos, have speculated that, in fact, the citizens of Shambhala actually will be coming from another planet. It's just speculation, but it's interesting, isn't it?
So that's the potential connection between...
And in fact, when I was there interviewing the Dalai Lama about oracles, you know, at the end I said, I'm doing this UFO film. You want to say anything? Let's talk about the Shambhala myth.
And how long did he talk about UFOs?
He didn't have much to say about UFOs. He had a lot to say about the Shambhala. About the Shambhala story. And just in terms of how there is a speculation that it could... They could come from someplace else.
But then I want to sum it up, and I don't want to sound too glib, but the work that they do on themselves internally,
their yogas,
their yogas connect with beings from other places. Yes, no?
I think in a very unfortunate way, yes. They don't really consider that important.
Yeah.
That's kind of obstacles on the path to enlightenment.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, Victor and I are wasting our time.
Let's cut that out right now.
Okay. Then I'm going to go home and thank you, David Cherniak.
Well, now you guys study Buddhism. Sorry, Errol. You know.
We are done, sir. We are out of time. We got about 15 seconds. Want to thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Really look forward to seeing your documentary, UFOs and the Politics of Reality.
Should be out in about a year.
About a year on the Canadian History Channel. Victor? Thank you, sir.
Good night.
To Dave Frelat and to Stuart Miller, thank you. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp.